Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of NatureNow at kptz.org. Hello, and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Nan Evans, and my guest today is Dr. Jan Newton, Principal Oceanographer with the Applied Physics Laboratory of the University of Washington and a professor at the UW School of Oceanography and the School of Marine and Environmental Affairs. Dr. Newton will also be speaking at the Port Townsend Marine Science Center's Focus on Oceans lecture series this coming Sunday, and she's graciously agreed to speak with us before she's in town on Sunday. But first, before we do that, let's hear this week's mystery sound. So, a little hint on that mystery sound. These are gregarious little birds, and they flit about in the topmost canopy of seed-bearing trees. Sometimes they actually hang upside down to peck at seeds. You'll also find them at backyard feeders, especially in the winter. They forage in tight flocks and twitter incessantly to each other. So let's see what's been going on around town, and I'm going to ask Nora Petrich, our wonderful sound engineer and editor, to help share this with me. So, Nora.
All righty. Up in the winter sky on Tuesday, January 8th, the moon reached its apogee, its greatest distance for its current orbit around Earth. The moon will be roughly 252,347 miles away.
Roughly.
Which is more than 13,000 miles farther than the average distance.
Curious. Well, and Marcia Swindeman reported on the recent Natural History Society walk at Eby's Landing on Whidbey Island. She writes, "We began our walk about 10:15 under bright sunny skies with a few clouds on the horizon and a south wind that whipped us all day long at maybe 10 to 20 miles per hour, trekking north up the bluff from the parking lot where the homestead is, we noted that the trees were sculpted by the wind, sort of a la the likes of the pines along the California coast near Carmel. But these, of course, were Doug fir for the most part. And then as we zigzagged down the bluff to the beach, we spotted several tiny prickly pear cactus. And according to Ken Wilson, who was on the hike, Eby's Landing is known for the cactus. Who would have thought? And then at the far north end of the lagoon, they hit the beach and spotted a single harbor seal in the nearshore surf and wind waves. On the bird list compiled by everyone on the walk, crows, gulls, red-tailed hawk, several bald eagles, maybe an osprey, towhees, song sparrows, double-crested cormorants, two greater yellow legs, that's unique, a northern harrier, bufflehead, common loon, harlequin ducks, and a Brandt's cormorant. Plus, they learned about the remarkable history of the preservation of Eby's Landing and the consortium of organizations and individuals it took to put it together.
On this same walk, Wendy Feltham shared that spotting an orange sea pen thrown up on the beach was a highlight for her. Usually sea pens, which are colonies of organisms related to corals, are anchored by bulbous feet in offshore sand and mud. They wave their vibrant bright orange feathery plume in the water current to capture small planktonic critters.
And if any of you have been out on the beaches recently, you no doubt have noticed the massive amounts of styrofoam and other plastics brought ashore by the recent king tides, storms, and high winds. Nature Now encourages you to take along a large plastic bag on your beach walk and pick up what you can. And of course, then dispose of it properly. And if you would like an encore discussion of the issues of plastics in the ocean, listen to the podcasts of two programs. They were number 376 and 379 that we did last summer with Janine Boire, director of the Port Townsend Marine Science Center. So my guest today is Dr. Jan Newton. Dr. Newton is a biological oceanographer who has studied the physical, chemical, and biological dynamics of Puget Sound and coastal Washington, including understanding some of the effects from climate and humans on water properties and habitat. Well, welcome, Jan.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
I'm so glad you're here. You know, I've got to share that when we first talked before the show, I was so impressed by the energy you brought to our conversation and the passion you had about your work. So I'm wanting to ask you the first question, which is, for you, what drives that passion and that energy that you bring to your scientific work?
Well, thank you. That's a great question. I guess I've always been fascinated by nature. I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, always near the water. Maybe there's just something innate about it. But I think as I've learned and developed into a scientist, the oceans really just fascinate me because they are the major feature on our planet. And yet, so many people don't really know that much about the oceans. And so, as I have studied the oceans, I've learned so much about how dynamic they are and how it affects the humans and life on Earth in so many ways. So that fascinates me, and I really enjoy doing the research. And then, you know, when I started out, I really just wanted to understand how things work. I was always the kid that was asking, how, why? Mm-hmm. So I think as you start to apply that to a scientific career, you're really in that inquiry mode. And then as I advanced, I think I learned more that, wow, some of these things were really important to either societal issues or decisions that people make. And so then that really drove me to want to understand it better so that I might be able to help others, you know, see what's going on. And so therein lies the passion. I guess you just don't go to sea and do these things if you're sort of blasé about it.
That's one way of looking at it. But as you sort of set about trying to understand, from reading a little bit about your background, you're coming at it from a whole picture or a mm-hmm. kind of a systems perspective. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about what makes that perspective unique? And then what kinds of information do you need to understand how it works?
Yeah, well, that's, I think, what fascinates me so much. You know, as you get advanced degrees, you tend to focus on a little aspect that you can really drill into and progress the science on it. And so I was studying, the pigments that are in, you know, like chlorophyll is a pigment in plants and diatoms, but it gets degraded. And I was looking at different kinds of pigments to understand different processes. So that's a little esoteric, but it's related to how organic material is flowing through the entire ocean and fixed from the atmosphere. It gets buried in the sediments. So it's really that global carbon cycle. And so I was really fortunate when I was a grad student at UW. My major advisor was a gentleman named Carl Lorenzen, and he really had this ability to look at the details, you know, and use things like different pigments, different elemental signatures, etc., but to look at that big picture and how it all fit together. And to me, that's the fascination, is where, you know, you can really try to see the big picture as well as the little picture. And you can't scrimp on the little picture because the big picture is composed of all the little pictures mm-hmm. together. But on the other hand, some people never go that next step to putting it into that higher picture.
Let's see. Let's think about the Salish Sea and the mm-hmm. outer coast. So the ocean waters kind of surrounding us. As you go about trying to understand how they work and you mentioned like the flow of material and energy through the different parts of the system. What are some of the first things you look at?
Yeah, sure. First, people look out at the the sea, whether it's Puget Sound, Salish Sea, the outer coast, you know, ocean waters, and they basically see a flat blue surface. And, you know, maybe it's lumpy because it's wavy, but, you know, at some scale, it's just this blue.
It's just
unknown.
That water out there, okay.
It's just that water, yeah. And it may be different colors, mostly gray around here, it seems. But it's just water, and you're looking at a surface. And the first thing that an oceanographer does typically is to probe down into that and with depth. And so the deepest part in Puget Sound is 200 meters or so off the coast. It gets much deeper, but, you know, in the near shore, it's around 100 meters or so. And so we have these devices, they're instrument packages that have different sensors for things like temperature and salinity, the depth, oxygen. You can put all sorts of sensors on there. We call that taking a profile of the water column. Oceanographers think of this concept of a column of water, and it just basically means if you drop a lead weight through, you know, from the sea surface down to the bed, that's the column of water that you're sampling. So now on top of that lead weight, we have all these sensors. As you're watching these sensors record their data in real time, it looks like squiggles on lines on a graph, and that may look really boring to some people, but to an oceanographer and to myself, I see the structure of what that water column has. So if it's straight up and down, that means it's very, very well mixed. What causes the mixing? Well, it's got to be a physical force like winds or tides. If there's squiggles in it, that means that it doesn't have those forces acting on it strongly enough.
And something else is happening.
Exactly. And so when you have lighter water, so warmer and fresher water over colder or saltier water, then you get what we call stratification. Strata, you know, a layer. And so that stratification is really important because if you're a diatom cell, a phytoplankton cell, you need light and you need nutrients. Well, if you're washed out of the euphotic zone where there's enough light to grow, you can't grow. But if you're in this stratified area, there's that little buffer for you to exist, and so you stay in the lit area. But then it becomes a resource limitation, perhaps, if there aren't enough nutrients. So in springtime, there's a lot of nutrients, right? So you get these big blooms. But then the population could use up all the nutrients. And so it's that whole, you know, boom-bust sort of situation. And so on any given day in any given area in the Salish Sea or off the coast, the water structure can be different, and it can be different in different areas, different times of the year. And so to me, that's fascinating, is to get a handle on that. So the first thing we really measure is what is that profile, and what is the water column telling us about what kind of habitat that would be?
Some of us can kind of visualize this, and we can think, okay, you mentioned there are going to be differences with certainly season, the inflow of fresh water, or, you know, various other seasonal things. And we think about, well, Puget Sound is different than the Strait of Juan de Fuca. And then both of those are different than the open ocean. How much, I'm going to call it variability. How much variability do you see between those sort of different habitats, let's say?
Yeah. Well, the outer coast, or where the coastal ocean is, the biggest factor that causes variation is the direction of the wind. You know, in winter like now, most of our winds are from the south, right? And we get these big storms. And in the summer, it's a little counterintuitive, but the wind direction changes. It's actually the northerlies that are associated with the warmer weather.
Well, yeah, and you can see it if you watch the skies around here. Yeah,
exactly. You can. And that doesn't mean that you'll never have northerlies in winter or southerlies in summer. But on average, we have southerlies in the wintertime and the opposite in summer. And that has a big influence because that causes a process known as upwelling when the winds are equatorward, so those northerlies. or downwelling when it's the opposite. And what happens then is because the Earth's rotation, the Coriolis effect and friction and all of these factors and forces together, the surface water, when we have the equatorward winds, is going to pull away from the coast. And you can't have a hole there, right? So, mm-hmm. so deep water comes up to the surface and replaces that void. So you kind of get this overturning. That happens in the spring and summer, and it brings up nutrient-rich waters, which is great for phytoplankton. Mm-hmm. You've got sunlight, you get nutrients. You have the best of all worlds.
So that occurs off the coast.
Off the coast, yeah. And then in Puget Sound, things get really complicated, and the Strait of Juan de Fuca is kind of intermediary between the two. So the Salish Sea, which is the Strait of Georgia, the Strait of Juan de Fuca, and Puget Sound, is an estuary, and that means that you've got rivers, fresh water flowing in, and that fresh water is going to continue to flow out, and it's headed to the ocean. And as it flows out, it entrains the salty water that it's flowing into. And again, you can't have a hole, so the deep water from the ocean is going to flow in. And so in the Strait of Juan de Fuca, you actually have two layers of different densities and different origins of seawater. So the top layer that's coming from the Strait of Georgia and Puget Sound, and then the deep layer that's coming in from the ocean. And of course, those have really different water properties.
So the top layer, more or less, about how thick is it?
Mm-hmm. More or less, it's about on the order of 50 to 70 meters.
Okay, so it's significant.
It's it is. And of course, it's going to vary. But what's really interesting is that the mean flow, the average flow, of course, you got the tides coming in mm-hmm. and out, but the mean flow is going to be out to the ocean in the surface and in to the basins at depth. And you can really see that the barrier between the two, we call it the pycnocline, meaning the change in density.
So say that again slowly.
It's called the pycnocline. So P-Y-E.
Okay.
Yeah, pycno.
Okay.
It means it's Greek for density. And so the cline, the change in density, pycnocline, can kind of bounce up and down, and there's a lot of factors that can affect that. But yeah, you're going to see that top layer.
And you'd be picking that up from your sampling devices that are going
mm-hmm.
down. Yeah,
That's right. And I teach a class out of Friday Harbor, the University of Washington labs up there, and we take students out, and we have a station in the Strait of Juan de Fuca, and you can really start to look at what depth that pycnocline is at. And when it changes from upwelling to downwelling conditions in fall, it's really interesting because that deep water is coming from the ocean, right? Well, if it's summertime, that's during the upwelling, and the deep waters that come up, those are cold. So that deep layer is very cold. In the winter, so as we go from summer to winter, so during fall, it switches to downwelling. So the source to the Salish Sea is now warmer waters. And so isn't that different?
Hmm.
So as
mm-hmm.
we go from summer to winter, that deep water actually warms up, and it's because it's not upwelled water, it's surface water that's downwelling. So that's a fascinating dynamic.
And that is interesting, yeah. Because I don't think about that, and it's in a way counterintuitive because you think winter ought to be colder, but it's
mm-hmm.
because of the upwelling and downwelling. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
yep.
Let's bring us into Puget Sound because I know, we're sitting up here just kind of at the entrance to Puget Sound, and I know there's an underwater ridge or sill.
Mm-hmm. Sill, yep.
Kind of out there.
Mm-hmm.
What happens in the sort of water characteristics as we then come into the sound?
Well, that's what's so fascinating about this area, because Puget Sound, was glacially carved, and the glaciers left these things called sills, which is just basically a big pile of sediment, gravel, and et cetera. But, you know, it's where the glacial scouring stopped, right, mm-hmm. and then retreated. And
yeah, it's so like a moraine on land, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah. Yes. And so you have sills at Admiralty Inlet. You have a sill down at the Tacoma Narrows. You have a sill in the entrance to Hood Canal. And these are features that were, you know, left from various processes that the glaciers did. Mm-hmm. So a long, long, long time ago, of course. But what they mean for the water circulation is now, if you have water coming in through a basin and suddenly now it shoals, well, what's going to happen? It's going to cause turbulence.
It's going to push up, right?
Yeah, it's going to push up. So now that water is going to spill over it and start to mix. And so I'm sure, you know, all of your listeners know, you know, you look out at the Admiralty Inlet and it doesn't sort of matter what tidal phase you're at. It's that you always see a lot of boils and mixing mm-hmm. and all of that sort of thing. And so that's really accentuated there. And if you're in, like, the main basin, like down towards Seattle, you look at the water and, you know, you might see some tide rips or things like that, but you more have a static surface. And so that sill causes mixing. And that's really an interesting aspect of the oceanography in Puget Sound proper, is that top layer, remember, an estuary is heading out. Well, what does that top layer have? It, since it has the freshwater signal, anything that humans are adding to it, whether that's nutrients or chemicals or what have you, that's in that top layer. Now, as it goes over the sill, it gets mixed, which, you know, some people say the solution to pollution is
dilution.
And so
right.
They would say that was a great thing. But then guess what happens? Now it's mixed down deep, and then what's the deep layer doing? It's coming back at you. We say that Puget Sound is retentive, meaning that not everything that is in the top estuarine layer actually goes out because of this mixing over the sills. And
so I'm appreciating sort of the
reflux.
Yeah, the cyclical nature of that. Then
yeah,
you know, things are moving
exactly.
around and up and down.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, kind of getting to the end of our time right now. I want to sort of take a big look. We're looking down. We're seeing Puget Sound, the Salish Sea. We've got water columns where all these characteristics are going to vary with depth. We've got things changing seasonally. We've got stuff coming off the land and stuff coming in from the open ocean. How do you characterize that? How would you describe that?
Well, I think to me what's fascinating is in my mind, because it's moving and because it's variable, it's almost like it is its own organism. You know, most people, when they think of habitat, you know, it's a forest. It's very static. And, of course, forests change and there's seasons and things like that. But it doesn't move. The thing with the oceans is it's all connected and it's all fluid. And so, to me, I find that really fascinating to see how things are changing and how that affects the life. So where plankton blooms happen and then how things like ocean acidification are changing mm-hmm. things. And that's going to be different depending on that ocean.
So it really puts a deeper meaning to the cliche, everything's connected to everything else, doesn't it?
Well, it really does.
Yeah.
Because, I mean,
it's not a cliche.
You know,
well, it is a cliche, but it's real.
It's true.
Yeah.
It's true. Yeah. And so, like a sailor, you know, like if you're in a sailboat, you can head out, you know, the Strait of Juan de Fuca, and you can go anywhere, you know, because you can sail over to Europe and you can circumnavigate the world. It's all connected.
Yeah.
But what an oceanographer realizes is it's not just horizontally all
right.
connected. It's vertically all connected. Yeah.
Jan, this has been great, and I am going to try to twist your arm to record a second show with us, because I'm sure there's so much more to talk about. Would you do that?
Oh, I'd be happy to.
Oh, great.
I'd be
great.
Happy to, Nan, of course.
Great. Well, don't miss Dr. Newton's lecture this coming Sunday, January the 13th at 3 p.m. at the Fort Warden Chapel. Her talk, titled Big Oceans, Small Sensors, Large Knowledge, is the fourth installment of this winter's Future of the Oceans lecture series presented by the Port Townsend Marine Science Center. So, what else is going on? Nora?
Yes, well, premiering Wednesday, January 9th on YouTube, watch Salish Sea Wild, Sea Doc's exciting new video series. Traveling from the ocean salmon streams to the rich upwellings of the Pacific Ocean, Joe Gatos and the Sea Doc team encounter the wildlife and iconic species that depend on this diverse environment. Joe has been a featured guest on Nature Now several times during the past few years, so we are certain that this new video series will be great.
And Dr. Robert Pallant, a founding director of the nonprofit Pacific Rim Institute on Whidbey Island, will share experiences restoring abandoned agricultural land to native oak prairie habitat. Dr. Plant will discuss not only the what's and how's, but also the why's of this work. The Olympic Peninsula chapter of the Native Plant Society is sponsoring this talk, which will occur on Tuesday, January the 15th, 6:30 p.m. at the Port Townsend Community Center.
Join Jefferson Land Trust Geology Group for a video illustrated tour of deep sea habitats off the coast of Washington and Oregon. Using high definition video from deep diving remotely operated vehicles, visit the Cascadia Margin, where methane rich fluids rise from hundreds of vents on the seafloor, sometimes explosively. The talk is presented by Dr. Deborah Kelly, a marine geologist and professor in the School of Oceanography at the University of Washington. The hour-long lecture starts at 4 p.m. on Saturday, January 19th at the First Baptist Church, 1202 Lawrence Street in Uptown Port Townsend.
And lastly, if you're interested, the Washington Department of Ecology is now taking comments on possible permits for four proposed Atlantic salmon farms, three in Kitsap County and one in Skagit Bay. Visit the Department of Ecology website for more details. The comment period is open through February the 25th. Now let's hear that mystery sound again. And I want you to listen for two types of sounds. There are the husky sounds that have whispering trills and slurs and short rising notes. And there are the wheezy contact calls. They've got long, harsh, upsweeping zweets that are tossed in amongst the longer songs. Well, that was a chattery group of pine siskins, very small songbirds with sharp pointed bills and short notched tails. Their uniquely shaped bill is more slender than most of the finches, and in flight, look for the forked tails and the pointed wingtips. Another identifying clue is that the pine siskins are very streaky birds, brown and white. And if you can see them, there's subtle yellow edges on the wings and tails. And I want to thank the Cornell Ornithology Lab, All About Birds websites, for sound recordings and information. So that's it for this episode of Nature Now. We hope you have enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news and information about the natural community where we live.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and engineered by Nora Petrich. The following music is Deep, Deep Ocean with Belinda Carlisle and George Harrison on slide guitar.